Go Loud.
What you waiting for? Put your back in it. Just a little more. Throw your weight in it now. Till your body okay. Work it hard and long. When you finish that.
The hip knocker.
All right, so a little while ago, before Terry took his break, we recorded this episode of Talking Bollocks with a very special guest, Professor Shane Bergen. He came in to us to chat all about Science Week, which is running from the 9th of November to the 16th of November. So I hope you enjoy it. This is a special episode of Talking Bollocks with thanks to Science Week, which is celebrating its 30th anniversary this year. Science Week is a national celebration of science with hundreds of events for people of all ages taking place across the country from the 9th to the 16th of November.
The theme for this year's Science Week is Then, Today, Tomorrow. In this episode, we're going to explore unexpected experiments. It's me, Terry Flower.
It's me, COB.
And today we're joined by Associate Professor in Science of Education at UCD, Shane Bergen. Shane, what's the crack? How are you?
Well, lads, how are you?
Thanks very much for coming into us.
No problem at all.
Shane, you're no stranger to this building, you were saying.
That's right, yeah. I've been doing a science programme in News Talk for 15 years. I'm, well, a contributor. I don't host it or anything like that, but future-proof on News Talk every Sunday morning with Jonathan McRae. I've been going on with Jonathan for the last 15 years, and I think the quality of what we've been doing has probably descended into farce at this stage in terms of just kind of taking the mick out of each other rather than focusing on the science. But what I do there is I go on every week and talk about science news, things that have happened in the science world that week, and some of it's funny, some of it's serious, some of it's sad. So it's great crack.
Well, look, I'm sure you're never stuck for anything to talk about. Like when it comes to the world of science, there's constantly innovation, there's constantly people that putting up theories, people disputing it, there's constantly facts and new data coming out. So I'm sure you're never stuck for anything to talk about.
Does social media play a big factor in that?
In science?
In people debating it all the time. Like, it feels like no matter what comes up about science, it has to be debated and it has to be debunked and everything. I feel like there's a negative view of science through social media that can lure people in, me included.
There's a negative view of everything through social media.
Valid point, Jane. We'll move on.
But yeah, you're right. And when Twitter started, myself and loads of scientists around the world were on it, talking to each other as well as talking to the public. And it was seen as really democratic, a marketplace of ideas, people coming out and giving their views, also sharing like results and things they had, and it was great. But that's of course before the algorithms kicked in, and it really has gone to pot now, and most scientists I know kind of try and stay away from the likes of X. But there are kind of, I think there's still a demand for people wanting to scientists to talk to each other, and also the public to talk with scientists as well. And that's really important, because if scientists are just going off and doing their work in universities or in companies and they're not talking to other people, you kind of have to ask, what's the point, you know? And also, if they're not talking to one another, it gives lots of opportunity for people who have bad motives to come in and start stirring things, disinformation, conspiracy theories, eroding trust. But I am glad to say that according to recent research, big global study, scientists are still amongst the most trusted profession in the world. Yeah, what do you reckon is at the bottom of that list?
Politicians, obviously.
Yeah. And who else?
Go on.
The media, unfortunately, which I think is a real problem, because the media are crucial when it comes to, they're called trust proxies. So in the media have a relationship with experts and scientists and everyone else in the world. They're the voice that the public hear, and they're the interlocutor, the bit in between. And it's super important for when it comes to building trust in anything, be it science or technology or whatever. So I'm disappointed to see media at the bottom or close to the bottom of that list.
Yeah, but I think that's a factor of people only listen to what they want to hear.
Yeah.
So if somebody telling you 2 + 2 = 4 and you say, no, it's 5, you're going to be like, well, he's lying. I'm actually right.
Yeah.
And people who align with you will be like, well, I'll never trust anyone that says it's 4.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah, and you can get that. You can kind of get people leaning into their tribe and thinking, you know, I won't even listen to that station or that program or that podcast because they don't say things that I agree with. And that's kind of unhealthy. In fact, in the university, like, there's a big job of work for us to do to make sure that we have a kind of a diversity of opinion and voices on various issues, while at the same time being mindful of not giving a platform to people who have, like, let's face it, like bananas ideas that would be extreme, you know. So and finding that balance between kind of being accommodating for lots of views and also knowing where the line is, that's really hard.
Yeah, but isn't that the whole fundamental of science though, is you pitch something and then we challenge it?
Yeah.
That's the whole point in science. Because if something is a constant like that, if you're like, no, this is it, then that's not a science. If you say this is how it is and that can't be challenged, then it's not a science.
Absolutely. Science is not absolute. Like, science is not just facts, you know. We think of science that way sometimes because that's the way it's presented in school. It's a big book of stuff you have to learn off, and that turns a lot of people off. But really, what science is truly about is about figuring things out with other scientists. And that with other scientists bit, the social part of it, is critical. Because if I just come out and come up with a theory and I give evidence, it's like, unless it's reviewed by peers and tested by the public, as you say, it's not really science, you know. So you have to be willing to have debate about it within the science context, and also to be able to go and talk about it in the public and kind of share what you're saying and listen to what people have to say in return about what you found and what it means. Because I can assure you, scientists do not know everything, and science is not the answer to everything either.
Brilliant. Shane, we start every episode with, like, we call it a zinger, which is like an either or a would you rather, or just a question that's out there, right? And I heard a mad theory.
Here we go.
That I have to put to you because, look, I'm just going to ask you. Right,
remember who I work with. So I'm a physicist. So mad theories are my thing. So off you go, yeah.
I heard that the spoiler.
Wait, hang on. Sorry.
I'm not going to say he's a robot, Calvin. Come on.
Just how he's presenting this to me, I'm like, where is he going?
Spire on O'Connell Street. Yeah,
yeah, the spire on O'Connell. That big yoke, that big pole that we have there, yeah?
The stiletto in the ghetto. Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
Is the spire taller in the summer?
Yeah.
Taller?
Absolutely, by a few centimetres.
Now, here's my follow-up question, right? Does that just shrink back down in the winter? Does it stay that tall?
No, it shrinks and it grows and shrinks depending on the temperature. So.
Yeah, I know a few things like that as well, yeah.
Shane, I don't believe that. That's hard to believe,
I know,
Shane.
I because the Eiffel Tower does the same.
It does, that's right, yeah.
Metal expands in heat. Am I right in saying this?
Yeah, absolutely.
Metal expands in heat. So obviously when you cool it down, it's going to come back down. It's
it doesn't
state.
Mean that there's more of it. Like if you were to weigh it on a hot day and weigh it on a cold day, it weighs the same, right? So it doesn't, like, there isn't extra spire. It's just that what is there spreads out. So all the bits of the spire, it's made of steel. So steel is made of iron with carbon, two elements, and they bond together, right? And the space between all the bits of the spire just grows when it's warm and it shrinks when it's cold. You can see proof of that when, like, you want to open a jar, right? You open a jar and it's stuck. If you heat the lid, it'll open. Because it'll expand. It's the same principle.
See, now, I love, sorry, Terrence. little like science experiments like that you can apply to your daily life at home, where people are stuck for something and they're like, oh, if you do this, that works. Everyone's like, how did you figure that out? And then you explain
you
the science behind it.
If someone asked you to open a jar and you started going down the science route, they'd appreciate that in the moment.
Not in the moment, but, like, you know, after the fact, you'd be like, if you're explaining to people, that was an experiment, the science behind it is how I knew how to do
exactly,
that. And you'd be like, Jesus Christ, because the one thing that it kind of relates to what you were saying at the start as well. If you have a closed-minded, like, approach and you keep science kind of locked away, it leads to misinformation. I think people are, especially in where we're from, I think people are led to believe through the education system that they're less than and maybe, like, even stupid.
Mm.
So they shut themselves away from these conversations. They're always felt like they're not included. So when someone else who sounds like them is relaying information to them, that they tend to believe them. So that's why I think conversations like this are crucial. So you say, actually, no, this is what's happening here. Don't listen to that person. They're leading you down the wrong path. This is the facts here, look, and I'm showing you in front of it. And it might be something as simple as opening a jar, or it might be something as simple, not as simple, as complex as explaining a theory or whatever. Like, you go online and you look at stuff. I do see fellas with, now they sound very convincing and they're saying this and they're saying that, like, the world is flat and here's why. And I've had conversations with people saying, you'd be surprised. I'm having conversations with people being like, this is why they're wrong. And I'm like, shining torches and putting balls and objects over that side. I'm like, look at the shadow cast there. That's happening in the world on a bigger scale. And they're like, oh, that makes sense now.
It happens everywhere now. I hear it, like, even with students. I teach a module called White Trust Science in UCD. And I'd have students in college that would be like, sometimes would subscribe to conspiracy theories, you know, about, say, 9/11 was an inside job or things like that. But I think what's really important for me, and maybe you guys feel the same, is that I don't think those people are somehow stupid or less than or anything like that. That sometimes there's just kind of an honest mistake. People think, well, I actually thought that, you know.
Yeah.
And there's a kind of a conversation that can happen then around maybe trying to give somebody some kind of knowledge. But then sometimes you realize there's an intention to being wrong, right? Disinformation as opposed to misinformation.
Yeah.
When you're trying to deceive someone. And there are people out there, of course, that are, they're clever. So you look at, like, why did we not ban smoking for so long? It was because there were people out there that were intentionally trying to deceive the public around the harms of tobacco, and they were clever. So what all they had to do was sow doubt, and made a podcast on this. They didn't have to say, oh, this is right and that's wrong. They just had to say, are you sure you're right? And then it was just enough doubt for people to go, God, if they're not sure, then I don't know what to do. And we saw the same thing happen when COVID came along and we've been told take vaccines or wear a mask or don't hang out with your friends in your house or something. All it took for people who wanted to kind of sow a bit of dissent was to sow doubt. And when you look at historically the reasons that people do that, there's two real obvious reasons: money and power. Yeah, they want to make money out of it or they want to take over something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Back to the spoiler.
Thanks. It's far more interesting, yeah.
Did we measure the spoiler to prove this, Shane? Or are we just going off like the Eiffel Tower or something?
Yeah, I don't know if anyone's actually... So, yeah, okay. So do you have to... Maybe the question is, do you have to measure it to know that it's true?
Yeah, that's where I was kind of getting
at. No, you don't, right? So you could do an experiment on a smaller scale. So you could take a piece of metal, right? It might be like the length of a ruler. And you could measure its length at 0 degrees Celsius, where it's really cold, and maybe like stick it in the fire and heat it up to, or in the oven, heat it up to 100 degrees and see, does it get longer, right? And it does, right? We do this. I've done this with students carefully. I wouldn't do it with kids because it'd be hot, but you could do things like that and you could see that it grows. And then you could extrapolate. You could say, well, if that one grows, maybe any piece of metal that's made from the same stuff will grow too. So if you have the Eiffel Tower, you have the spire, the Statue of Liberty, you have a bridge, you have a railway track, anything made out of metal, it'll expand if the temperature goes up. And so you're able to kind of say there's a general rule that would work, a scientific principle at play. Yeah, but I'm really curious now to know, has anyone actually measured the height of the spire?
I doubt it.
Like, the air government, there's not a chance. Sure, they didn't measure the width of the door frame in the doll to get the printer in.
That's true. isn't there a thing about how they changed the light in the top of the spire? You know, there's a light at the top.
Yeah.
Somebody has to change that bulb.
Yeah, he's not going up on a ladder, is he?
No, you can go up inside it but to a certain point, but I don't know what to do at the very top then. Maybe it's like a series of pulleys or something. Might have a wire or something. But
they have a thing underneath there as well, like a little basement thing that they store things in when they create it. Yeah, like a letter from the Lord Mayor. And an Argus book and all.
Yeah. An Argus book.
Yeah.
And a menu.
There was a
restaurant menu.
A temple bar menu somewhere, to show the prices of things.
Okay.
When was it made? 2001?
Yeah, around, it was meant to be open for the millennium.
I think 2003, was it?
But it was...
Because we'd done something on the 20th anniversary.
Yeah.
I think it was 2003.
Yeah, I think
there smokes in it? Oh, that's what you said.
Oh,
you,
yeah, there's 20 blowing it, yeah.
Yeah, there's smokes in it as well.
Yeah. I think back then you were still trying to say it was healthy, weren't you? Shane, overall, what is actually Science Week?
Okay, so it's like, good question. I ask myself this a lot. It's like, so I'm a scientist, so kind of Science Week's a bit funny for me because it's like every week is Science Week, but Science Week is a special effort made to focus on science for a week. So there's loads of festivals, there's loads of like things you can do that's all for the public. So like, for example, I'm launching a children's book in a couple of days, and it'll be out during Science Week. And what I'm going to do is run a workshop for kids during Science Week where I'll get to do science experiments with them. So there's loads of stuff happening like that across Dublin and across Ireland, thousands of events in different communities. And it's been on the go a long time. And the people that funded Research Ireland have put a huge amount of effort into making sure there's lots of different types of events too, from things we can go and listen, things where you can go and take part, things we can go and learn.
Brilliant. What got you interested in science personally?
Yeah, it's like there wasn't some big plan, right? Like, I think a lot of people, I don't know about you guys, but a lot of people when it comes to talking about their careers, often we can reverse engineer these things and going, oh yeah, I always knew when I was like six I was going to do this, and it's a big plan. I think that's just something we tell ourselves. There wasn't a big plan for me to become a scientist. It was just a subject in school that I really liked and that I enjoyed. And my dad worked in a lab at the weekend. He worked in sales, but at the weekend he used to go into the lab. He'd done like a science degree in college. And I used to go in with him, and I was about 5 or 6. I remember being in the lab with him and enjoying it. It's kind of like just a place you could go and play, and there's all this stuff. And of course, before the days of health and safety, so I could go in and do it with him. And he worked in animal medicine. So he used to go in and kind of figure out what was wrong with sick horses. And so I used to go in with him. And it's probably a mixture of that and then just liking that subject in school, that when I decided to go on to go to college, I was like, oh, the best advice I got was do the subject you enjoy doing. So I chose science. So I remember going to a career guidance fella, and he said to me, oh, I think you should be a teacher and or an educator. And at the time I was like, oh, I couldn't think of anything worse. Like, I did not imagine myself as a teacher. But it's funny, as I stayed in science, right, and did my degrees and worked in physics and worked with these tiny materials called nanomaterials, started to realise that more of my passion, more of my interest was about communicating science and teaching science. So I ended up kind of becoming a science educator, a science communicator. The guy, the career guidance guy, was right. You know, he nailed me at 18, and I just didn't want to listen, but he was right. He could see what I was kind of perhaps drawn to. Mm. But I suppose that raises a bigger question. Are we destined for careers, or is it just what happens? Like, it's probably a bit of more the latter, isn't it? It's just a bit of random luck as to what happens, you know, where you end up going. And are you willing to go with the flow, or are you going to push against it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know what I've been talking there about how you can use science at home and for little things like bleeding, opening jars and all that carry on. But how, like, obviously I'm not in school anymore, I'm nearly 30. And like, science was a thing of school.
Yeah.
How do we get people who are older now to get interested in science and to understand it? And do you have to go and study it maybe, or?
Like, the thing I say to students in UCD, and a lot of the students I teach are not doing science degrees. They're doing all random things. They say, like, we're living at a time now where science plays a big role in lots of just big stuff in society. Like, climate change is effectively a science issue. We're all kind of grappling with how we manage AI, another science or tech issue. We just lived through a pandemic, big health science issue. There's loads of stuff now in our world that is sort of touching on science. So what I'd say to the public, and I'd say to my students, is I think my goal would be for people to think about these things, right? And know that when they're getting advice about how to live their lives or what to do or what to spend their money on, that they feel informed and they don't feel like they're always on the back foot with it going, I don't know what that is. I don't know what they're talking about. What's a vaccine? Like, how do I know what to give my kids when it comes to medicine? When people are telling me to get the house retrofitted, what's going on? Is the sea level in Dublin really going to rise? Like, we're building apartments right beside the sea, despite the fact that the sea level will rise. There's nothing we can do about it. And we're building flats and building houses in places within 50 years, they're going to be underwater. So this is like these sorts of things, right? It's like, so it's just for the public just to know and then to think about what that means for their life. I'm not telling them what to decide. I just want them to have access to that information, so they can make the best choices for themselves when it comes to doing their day-to-day stuff or when it comes to voting in people that have to make bigger decisions. I don't ever think it's a scientist's role to tell people what to do. Rather, we should offer the scientific knowledge and expertise that we bring and put it out into the public space and let the public do with that what they want.
Yeah, that's class, yeah. I've loads of, like, I'll put them down here. I've heard loads of things that are, like, scientific, let's say. If we put that slice of bread or toast, yeah, and throw it in the air, will it always fall on the buttered side?
More likely to fall on the buttered side.
Why,
yeah,
is that?
Absolutely.
The butter can't be that heavy.
No, it's to do with friction, right? So when the thing's rotating, right, the butter side has less friction. So it's more likely as it rotates to land on butter side. And somebody got what's called an Ig Nobel Prize for that a couple of years ago. Yeah. Yeah, there's always like, there's a whole section of science is about random science experiments like that one. Or somebody else got an experiment that figured out that most mammals take 21 seconds to pee.
I feel like we missed a trick. We could have got one of those.
Yeah. Yeah, or there's an optimum way to dunk your biscuit in tea.
What is it?
Yeah, well, seemingly, and I actually got students to try and test this, right? It's a lot of care has to go into your choice of biscuit. So a chocolate coating can help with structural stability. Right. And you want to dip it at an angle, but make sure that you obviously keep a hold on a part of the biscuit. And you slide it in at an angle, and I can't remember the time, but there is an optimum amount of time that you can put it in there for before the whole thing will fall apart and land at the bottom of your cup. So there's like people, like scientists do think about these things. When I was in Trinity years ago, we had one of the world's slowest experiments. So we had something called a pitch drop. So it was a lump of black tar and it was in a funnel looked black in a glass funnel and it was dripping through it, except the drips took around 7 years for each drop, right? So it takes 7 years for one drop to fall. And there'd only been a couple of these around the world. The Trinity one was set up in the 1940s, I think. No one had ever seen the drop fall. No one ever witnessed
it.
They all missed it. And there was a fella in Australia who spent loads of time with his one. His dropped every 10 years. The first time he stayed in the office all weekend so he wouldn't miss it. And he went to the loo. He missed
it. No way.
Yeah.
10 nah, years it's always later, the same. When you go to the toilet and you're watching a football match, there's a goal. It's always the same. That's science.
It's probably a science thing. Yeah. If the match was 10 years long, parents, I'm wearing a nappy.
There you go. You see, you should have been doing this experiment. So 10 years later, there was a camera right in front of it. The camera didn't work, right? So there was some problem. It was a video camera. It was the 90s or something. And there was a third incident. So he missed 30 years of the drops, right? Yeah, God love him. Like, lovely man. I ended up talking to him because in Trinity, we had one. And I said, this one looks like it's going to go. So we stuck a webcam in front of it and we caught it dropping, right? So we caught a drop and it was like, if ever I was going to go viral for doing something, I never thought it would be for this. Just like a random black kind of very viscous liquid dropping through a funnel. Just a plop. And like, it looks like solid glass, but it fell. And so we caught it on video and it got a lot of attention. We didn't win any awards or anything like that, but it got a lot of attention just for how random it was. So yeah, there's a whole area of science, kind of random stuff like that, that people do. Sometimes that random stuff ends up being important, right? Like, for example, the X-ray was completely random in how it was discovered. And the same when it comes to looking at the kind of the hiss from the origins of the universe, how we know that happened. It was all to do with a story with pigeon poo and a fella trying to clean a telescope. So there's all this kind of stuff that happens the whole time. Just, you think scientists are, like, often the perception, public perception of scientists is you must be very brainy, you must know everything, and you must be kind of a little bit like Sheldon Cooper, right, from the Big Bang Theory. And yes, there are some people like that. I studied with lots of people like that. Nothing wrong with them. But equally, there are just an awful lot of people who are just going about doing a job. And sometimes random stuff happens in the same way it does for every other job. But it's knowing what to do when a random thing happens. I think it's like whether it just kind of happens and ends, or whether you're able to see what happened, why it happened, and make up a story, like a science theory, to try and explain, oh, maybe this means dot, 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 you know?
But see all this now, this would lure me straight into science, like. I'd go straight and study science now if it was all of this carry on here, because I love to hear all this. And I need to go back to your man in Australia that missed the drop, yeah? Did he know that drop was going to be every 10 years, yeah?
Yeah.
And he missed that drop when he went to the toilet?
Yeah, it was like 10 years plus or minus a month or something. Like. So it's like he was looking at it and it gets thinner and thinner as it's going to, like, up, and he went to the loo because, like,
why would he go to the toilet?
Well, sure. He was in his office for the whole weekend, like, so what could he do? You know, he had to
wear the
nappy.
Yeah. What?
Was he traumatized? Like, you said you spoke to him, yeah?
Yeah.
Was he traumatized?
He was talking down off a bridge.
Well, when the Trinity drop dripped, we had to ring him and tell
him. Rubber in, like?
Like, yeah. No, it's just like, that's the, going back to your thing about scientists talking to each other. So he was the first person we thought of. So we better ring him. And he was, like, what was really nice was he didn't feel like we'd scooped him or anything. Instead, he was like, can I see it? He just wanted to see it. He was curious. Now, I'd say, like, there was probably a degree of disappointment. Now, their experiment was much more controlled than our one. Like, in Trinity, it was just on a dusty shelf. And we used to, like, it was there. It was kind of set up from a different time as a kind of a demonstration. It wasn't trying to prove anything. It was just trying to show that glass can flow. Or, like, there are very viscous materials, like pitch. And there wasn't any kind of reason for doing it, except that's cool. So when we discovered, or when we saw the thing happen, we had to tell him first. Yeah. And then we told the media.
And has he seen the drops?
Yeah, he saw his own one. His own one did drop. But he got, because of both the unfortunate nature of what he was doing and because of his kind of lifelong kind of dedication to it, he did win the Ig Nobel Prize for his
work. Right, okay. Yeah, so really, I'm glad to hear he got something out of it.
Absolutely, yeah. No, he's famous for it, like, in the science world, of course, yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Do you ever see the science behind the point of Guinness?
Yeah.
Yeah, what?
Yeah, it takes 198.5 seconds for a pint of Guinness to settle.
And the bubbles go down in Guinness, not up.
Because, like, there's nitrogen, there's carbon, the hops, all that. Do the Guinness tone. I swear to
it's
God,
very
blow
good.
Your mind. Yeah. It'll blow your mind.
What do you mean
signs.
The bubbles? What say the bubbles go down now?
So you know when you're looking pint of Heineken or something like that, or like lager, right? So you see that you can see all the way through the glass, and the bubbles will go up.
Yeah.
Right. But in Guinness, if you look carefully, right, because it's black, you see the bubbles go down. So it's because in the Guinness, it's like a fountain effect. So in the middle, the bubbles are going up, but on the edge where you can see them, they're going down.
A lot of science behind the Guinness tag. I promise you.
They actually, when I was a student years ago, they sent in kegs of Guinness to Trinity for us to do experiments on.
Tell us what the light.
We only needed a drop, like half a cup. But they sent in like barrels of it. And so it was all used.
Yeah. Didn't go to waste. Just a little more.
You are mentioning things there. I have down here penicillin and super glue were invented by accident.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Fleming was the name of the guy from penicillin, and he was doing experiments, I think it was early 20th century, and he came back from his holidays and he noticed something in the bin. So he had like kind of thrown out stuff but didn't put the bins out. And when he came back from his holidays, he noticed on one of these kind of plates that he'd put out in the bin that there was an unusual growth. And so he discovered basically that he was able to kill bacteria using this new material, penicillin. So like, it was only the beginning of it, and he coined the term antibiotics. It did take a while to catch on, but combination of him doing that work and other people interested in the same thing meant that like when the wars were going on, and there was a lot of people kind of getting injured and would have loads of infections that were dying from like just basically getting a scratch out in the fields. If they were running across like, you know, trenches and things like that, people were dying from things that would be cured by a dose of penicillin. So there was a lot of interest in getting these things sorted out. And yeah, he discovered a whole area of medicine. You're talking about superglue. Superglue came about another thing, unfortunately, connected with war. There was an engineer who was trying to make transparent sights for a gun. So you know, you're looking through a gun. You know you're looking through a gun.
You know, so what do you put up during your weekend, Jen?
So if you're like in a gun, you can have a sight. You're looking through it, try and get see where like to have the cross. You make sure you're going to kind of hit what you want to hit. He was trying to invent a transparent plastic for doing this, but he realised when he was doing it that was incredibly sticky. He'd inadvertently discovered superglue.
There's a lot of Irish scientists, isn't there, throughout history that people won't realise have famous discoveries.
Tons of them, yeah. But it's kind of it's a tricky one in one way when you look back in the past, because a lot of them were kind of like, they're perceived as being Anglo-Irish, right? So they're kind of seen
West
as...
West Brits.
Yeah, exactly. So I think there's a bit of... where we don't seem to mind talking about a lot of the Anglo-Irish poets and writers in the same way we're very proud of those. I think there's, for some reason, I've never quite understood it, we don't seem to kind of own the Irish scientists and the Irish engineers in the same way. So like, there was the world's largest telescope in Ireland a couple of hundred years ago in Burr County Offaly. It's, well, parts of it are still there. And a rich guy who owned the castle there, he was the Earl of Ross, I think, he discovered certain galaxies out in space by looking through this huge telescope, largest in the world. I know putting a telescope in cloudy Offaly doesn't seem to make sense, but that's where he lived. So there was him. There was Kelvin, who was from Belfast, and he...
that's the temperature.
Temperature guy, exactly, yeah. There was Boyle from Boyle's Law, something to do with gases and pressures and things like that. So... and tons of them, and like there was the first person who split an atom was Irish as well, Ernest Walton. And so there's tons and tons of people. They're kind of more historical characters. And of course, there's a lot of Irish scientists now that are doing groundbreaking work. There's a good legacy of them, but they tend all to be male, all to be from privileged backgrounds and have that kind of Anglo-Irish lineage. And there's nothing wrong with that. But I think for some reason, when the new state was formed, there was a sense that we're letting go of all that now. You know, the new Irish state isn't going to really bother doing that. So it took a long time for science and research to kind of really get going in Ireland. The state was broke when we started. So like, they couldn't really make a case for putting tons of money into research and science when people needed basic things. So it took a long, long time for science to get going, even though De Valera was a mathematician and had an interest. Yeah.
Shane, earlier on you were talking about like the stereotypical idea of what a scientist is, like people like Sheldon Cooper. We're all about champion opportunities for working class people and working class communities. Why is it important, and is it really full of people like Sheldon Cooper, and why is it important to diversify science?
Is it really full of people like Sheldon Cooper? No, but there are people like Sheldon Cooper, right? You know, there are, let's be honest. Like, and sometimes the traits we'd associate with Sheldon Cooper, right, are traits that can make you a really good scientist. You can be very focused on something, kind of not see the rest of the world around you. You're just focused on the thing, even though it might be obscure, and that's your thing. Good for you, right? But is it important that there is a diverse community of people in science? Absolutely, right? Because if there's a load of reasons. If you've one tiny group of people who are in charge of or doing anything, you get a really narrow perspective on how that works. And it can be detrimental to the thing you're trying to find out. So a classic example has been some of the early work in climate, right? Or climate, kind of how we respond to the climate emergency. Scientists or engineers, often a kind of an ivory tower, would make a decision, we're going to stop doing this and we're going to start doing that. But they mightn't think about how that connects with people who live in certain communities, say like changes to agricultural practices, get rid of the cows or something like that. If you don't have people who are from a rural background as part of the science community as well, you mightn't get the richness of that local perspective, right? I spoke to a woman who was from the Arctic in Canada, and she was talking about scientists arriving to try and understand the movements of animals there, but they were completely disregarding the indigenous knowledge that her community had. She was from an indigenous community, and she said it took a while for them to realize there's often wisdom in other communities, and the science itself becomes better if it has more diverse voices. So I think in order for science to be done well and for science to be trusted and trustworthy, it should be representative of the population that it serves. Like, you can't have science just being an elite thing for elite people. It would be bad for science and it would be bad for the public. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Great, but like, we have a lot to do, though, to make that right. Because when you look at who's doing science, it's all a function of who's getting into college, what kind of schools get preferential treatment and all of those things. So we go right back to a fundamental level and see education as a universal right. I wouldn't call it an equal right. I don't think it's equality of opportunity. The way I think about it is equity of opportunity. Like, and to recognize that some people just have, and it's no fault of their own, just from where they were born, where they went to school, who they are, they'll have an advantage that someone down the road or in another county may not have. And it's only right and fair for us to give every young person, every person, an equitable shot at getting wherever they want to go. Because ultimately, I think you'd agree, based on the work you guys do, it's in everyone's best interest that we all get to be the best people we can be.
Terence always says there was a gap for someone like us to have a podcast. I think there's a gap there for somebody, I don't know whether they're an influencer or not, just to do like a series on Instagram or TikTok, just doing like basic science stuff. So people have like a basic fundamental idea of what science is, you know, like simple stuff. Like,
yeah.
Like even saying stuff like the spire expands in the summer.
Yeah.
Like, I'd say there's a lot of people that listen to this and be like, what? You know, but like,
well, I'd have been all over the TikTok saying that, yeah?
Yeah. You know, I'm just going to, we'll cut this, Terry, and you can do it if you want. But like, even so people know, when something will come on in the news, people are like, oh, you kind of know where that's at, that originating from.
Yeah.
Like, I remember when I started work, we went on a graduate program, and part of that program is you had to give a presentation to test your presentation skills. A fellow who I was working with had just done a master's in this topic, and I was like, what are you doing here, first of all? But what they had done was they were working on cancer treatments to take white blood cells, train them to fight tumours, and then put them back in your body. And I was like,
amazing.
Me and you shouldn't be working for the same company, first of all. But like, seeing stuff like that, that blew my mind. And then I was listening to the news the other day, that's at the evolving now, they're like going for human trial. And I was like, there's a fella I was working with like 8 years ago working on that. And now I'm at the scene that like the stages it's gone through.
Yeah.
So I kind of knew already when they were talking about that. I was like, oh, I know what that is.
So you know? Like, I suppose I have a question for you then. It's just like, a lot of scientists try to do that, right? Kind of put out their story and say, this is what we're doing. And sometimes the best way is just two friends chatting about it. You happen to know one of the research scientists. You get to figure out what's happening there. This is often they can be met with the reluctance from media to say, oh, people are not interested in that. Do you think it's because the scientists don't do a good job at explaining it, or media bias, or maybe a bit of combination of these things or other things? Like, why do you think it's hard for scientists to find platforms to talk about these things?
I would say it's a mixture. Who the media put out there is who they think will do well. So if they think your topic, what you're talking about, people are not going to tune in, they're not going to give you
exactly
a chance.
Yeah.
But again, what I go back to is that you start from the basic. Like, I mean, like, school level stuff.
Yeah.
Because you can't assume that everybody was paying attention in school, because school isn't for everybody. Yeah. So people will be leaving school where a boy has been like, oh, when I hear this stuff online or on the news, I'm not going to tune in, because I was always made to feel stupid when this stuff was being discussed in school. So start from there and then just build her up.
But isn't that, like, speaking personally, there is a perception issue that science is boring. So, yeah, like, if you mentioned science to me prior to doing this episode and looking into, like, theories and inventions, I'd be like, science, nah. Like, that's just not for me. But then I was looking into it, and obviously we did a bit of research coming in here, and I was looking at theories and inventions and all this, and it's all science-based. And I'm going, oh my God, I'm all over this. This is going to be great, like.
Yeah.
So I had a perception issue 2 hours ago. You know what I mean? And now I'm sitting here and everything is really interesting. And like Calvin was saying, it is basic stuff, but it's making it fun as well.
I think you're right. Absolutely. I think that public perception is one many people will have, right? About science being hard, science being about trying to memorize facts in school, or people being told you either get it or you don't. It's a classic with maths. People just say to you, you know, oh, you just can't do it. So in other words, we give up. Right, it's like, forget about it, as opposed to like, well, maybe we could make this more interesting, maybe I could be a better teacher, etc. So I think that there's a lot of work for us to do as a science community to do a better job at how we teach science and how we talk about science in the public. And when it comes to both of those, or particularly the education piece, I think the key thing is actually people rolling up their sleeves and doing it, right? It's far more interesting to try and figure things out by doing experiments. I don't mean like big mad ones or anything like that that require a load of equipment. I just mean kind of everyday stuff, right? You talked about opening the jar. What about like trying to heat it up and open it? Other things like that you can do around the house, maybe with kids or in your own area. Like I used to ask engineers years ago, just as a problem when I taught them, how many leaves will fall in Dublin this autumn? Like number wise, and see what they do, right, to try and figure it out. It's a classic type of problem in science called a Fermi problem, where you have to demonstrate your capacity to be able to reason things. There isn't a number, like I think it was 10 billion-ish, right? We figured it out, or roughly. But if somebody gets to 9 billion or 20 billion, it's like, we're not going to fall out over it.
Yeah.
It's how you thought about it.
Of course.
Yeah, and the best answer I ever got from a student was roughly the same number as last year.
Yeah. But I think,
but they're interesting, those sorts of things, right? Like, you know, or like, why are there cracks on the pavements when in Ireland, like, what, we've a load of like cracks in the pavements because we've a load of rain and then you get frost and so it cracks, and it's like these sorts of things, right?
Why,
like,
have I never even thought about that?
Yeah, or my friends ask me questions all
like
the time,
concrete.
If you have hot soup, is it better to like stir it to cool it down or just skim off the top? These sorts of like random things that I'm like, I don't know, I don't have the answer, but like we could try and figure it out, maybe try something. And kids are intuitively good at doing this stuff, and I think all of us, though, we're all kids once upon a time, and I think we like playing and like doing experiments and trying things and testing things if we feel that we're not going to be told we're stupid.
Yeah, right? Yeah,
that's the crucial bit for any of us. And I don't just mean I never feel that. Like if you ask me, I'm not sporty, but if you ask me to go out and do something sporty, my initial thing would be people will look at me and they'll think I'm stupid, that I'm not able to do it. So if I was doing it somewhere safe, somewhere where there was a bit of crack, maybe I'd be more inclined. And I'm thinking science could be done exactly the same way. Make people feel like it's kind of welcoming and it's not going to tell them that they're wrong, you know, just from the get-go.
You were talking about perception. You don't realise how much, like, the everyday man has more access to science and are applying science now than they were, say, 30 years ago. Look at the gym. Like, look how many more people are, like, living healthier lifestyles now, and they don't even realise it. Like, they're able to measure their meals. They know what's good for them. They know what's bad for them. Calorie deficits.
Jesus, yeah.
Building muscle and all. You're like, you're applying science to your day-to-day life. You don't even realise what's going on there. And it might even be something as simple, like, you speak to your personal trainer and he says, I'm putting you on a calorie deficit, and you know, right, I'm burning off more than I'm putting in, and that's at the simplest form. But then you break it down further, what's actually happening there and what you're eating and the nutritional benefit to that. You're like, fuck, there's a lot of science behind this and I'm living that.
Yeah.
Another example is, do you ever see when you spilled something in your ma's house? She doesn't just go out and get a cloth. She gets a certain product and cleans for that. Whereas, let's say you spilled red wine and he spilled tea.
Hang on, why is your ma getting the chemical?
Because they're better than us. We haven't a clue. We just get the mop, regardless.
My ma's using vinegar to clean the windows.
She's right.
She uses vinegar to clean the windows. The place smells like the chipper.
I was reading a research story, actually, just recently for Future Proof, where they're they're, instead of always having to use kind of harsh chemicals like bleach, they're able to use light now to try and clean clothes. Blue light. So it does exactly the same thing, except no chemicals. This is amazing.
But that's what I'm saying. So like your man knows if you're cleaning like the cooker, you use this and you do it that way. Whereas I get the cloth wet, wipe it. She's like, no, you're doing that wrong. You do it this way. And then if you're cleaning like the table, you use something else. I'm like,
see, when I used to work in Tesco, someone like spilled a bottle of oil, you'd put salt on it.
Yeah, to soak it up.
And it'd soak it up and then you'd clean it. Oh, he was amazed when I first seen that. They put the salt, it's like it shrinks it. But like, in front of your eyes, like, not over time. Like
it dissolves or something, does it?
Yeah, you put the salt on the oil and then it's like it just starts shrinking it. And then you get like, whatever you want.
The same with a grease fire. Don't pour water on a grease fire. You know, stuff like this. Like
that sounds like an old phrase that's like...
No, I think it's true. My brother's a fireman and I did a show about fire, but I got that bit right at least.
If you were cooking, like, say, the defat fire and I went up in flames, you throw water on that, you're in for all the trouble.
That's an experiment you shouldn't do at home. Yeah.
there's stuff like that. Even there, like, I have a friend who was a fireman and he was telling me, like, let's say there's a house on fire. Don't smash the window to get in, because
the oxygen's
going to get in and the fire's going to burst out then and shit like that. And you're like, what? But people don't realise, like, fire needs oxygen to burn. So if you smash the window, you're giving it another source of oxygen coming in from the outside, so it goes straight out to that. That's the science behind it.
Didn't know that.
There you go.
See, that's what I'm saying.
I could have killed someone and myself and all there. I'd definitely put the window through.
You have a candle, Terrence. You have a candle there, like a tea light in front of you, and you put that cup over it, the candle's going to go out.
Yeah, valid point.
It's going to burn the oxygen that's in the cup. You know
it's
what
clever,
I mean?
That, yeah. Science is needed. Science is needed.
You heard it here first, yeah.
I'm telling you, Professor Pepper.
Shane, what's been the biggest invention of the last... Obviously, this is just completely subjective, but what's been the biggest invention of the last 100 years or 10 years?
Oh my God, that's a huge question, right? So in terms of like, what's the biggest science breakthrough in the last... Jesus.
This is probably subjective, is it?
Yeah, definitely.
I suppose, what's my favourite? Oh God. When I think about it, like a lot of them have... Say, like, things that were unexpected, right? The internet was a consequence of a science experiment. It wasn't, like, invented in order for us to have social media and, like, have websites and all that kind of stuff. The internet was invented by scientists who were trying to send data from one place to another at the Large Hadron Collider in Switzerland, right? So, you know where they discovered the Higgs boson, the big thing under the ground. It cost billions of euros to build. It's looking to understand the nature of matter, the stuff we're made out of. And it's been there for decades. It's one of the most expensive and perhaps most obscure science experiments you could think of. It's really cool.
Long or something,
yeah, it's 26 kilometers.
Oh, is it? Jeez,
is the ring. Yeah, so
you're a bit off.
But like, they are credited as one of the groups that basically started the internet, right? So when you think about what our lives would be like, probably brilliant if we didn't have the internet, right? But that's like just a consequence of a science experiment. There's tons of examples of when we went to the moon, lots of technology came about as a result of it. So you're asking me about inventions. We often think of inventions as tech. But tech is different to science, right? Like, it's just as engineering is different to science. It's not one's better or anything like that. It's just they're slightly different. Technology often comes about as a consequence of a scientific discovery. And then marketing people get involved and determine there's people who want to spend money on this, and off we go. So, like, I reckon the internet is probably up there as one of those biggest things. Also, we've been able to understand a huge amount more, like, about biology. I'm not a biologist. I don't pretend to know that much about it, except that it's really hard. But, like, we were able to understand the basics of our genome and what the computer code that makes us us and these sorts of things. So we've, like... There's never been more people doing science than there is now. So like in the world, so the amount of scientists that are out there, the variety of things that they're doing are as big and as broad as you can imagine, from the super duper, from understanding the nature of time, understanding the expanse of the universe, whether there's life outside of the Earth, whether we're unique, whether there are planets around other stars that might have water on them, all that kind of stuff, down to tiny things about understanding the nature of matter, what we're made up of, and the materials that we can use to build in our world and build technology, to things that are alive, things that are not alive, like it's vast. So like, when I come on shows like this, I'm often worried going, what have they asked me about something in science that I don't know? It's like the amount of stuff that I don't know is enormous. But what I do feel is confident that I could go out there and kind of either talk to another scientist who tell me, or I could read about it in a book or online to learn more. And it's like being like just the enormity. It's like there seems there are no limits in terms of, well, there are limits, I'll get back to that, in terms of the things we might know. And actually, just because it's important, I should stress, science cannot nor will it ever know everything. Right. So my wife's a kind of a philosopher, psychologist, and she was like really kind of pushed me in terms of when I talk about science to remind me that there are certain things, but that the nature of humanity that science will never, ever be able to know. Like what makes a good life? What makes you happy? Science can't answer that. Right. What makes you well, like as opposed to healthy? Science can't answer that. So there are tons of questions that science just, like, it might try, but in fairness, there's probably far better ways to go and ask those questions or respond to them. And that's why in a university, we shouldn't just have scientists, but we need philosophers, we need psychologists,
dreamers.
We need historians, we need dreamers, we need people that can write stories, and we need them to come from all different backgrounds, all different parts of the world, and kind of come together and just celebrate the fact that we like ideas.
Shane, I know we're doing this episode, partnering with Science Week and getting it done. I didn't expect it to be this interesting.
Thanks.
No, and I'm actually being serious when I say that. I wonder, when you talk about the media not giving science enough airtime, would it be because not every scientist has a personality like yourself? There could be a lot of scientists that are maybe boring, like the perception says. I think if there was more scientists like you, and I'm sure there definitely are, I think media platforms would be jumping all over you to get you on. And even whether it was just for fun or whether it was for serious topics, I think it's an absolute no-brainer. Look, I'm sitting here now going, I know I can't get through everything that I want to get through with you today. So I'm saying in my head, as soon as you leave, I'm saying to Siobhan and Calvin, let's book him in again. Yeah. And we'll do a whole episode on just the maddest inventions. Because, like, this is so interesting. I know there's going to be many, many, many people listening to this going, I'm all over science. Like, it's brilliant.
Do you know your man, do you ever see him, Terry, Neil deGrasse Tyson?
Yeah.
Doesn't he do, like, a YouTube series where, like, he breaks down films?
Yeah, that's right.
And, like, whatever's going on in films, he's like, oh, here's why that was a good idea, because this is what's really happening, blah, 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 blah. And here's why, oh, that won't work in real life because blah, 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 blah. And you're like, fuck, actually, I didn't know that.
And is this only all films like Interstellar? And
yeah, a lot of them are. But, like, you know what I mean? He gives you the science behind, like, oh, when he fucking, they shot that rocket and it turned around and came back, that's why that wouldn't happen. And this is why that could happen.
It's clever. You know, like,
oh, I get that. It
is clever. Now. And there's a real market and need for that kind of, just kind of being out there as part of popular culture. Science is part of the world. And then there's the more serious bit of, like, you know, if we were talking about vaccines in a serious way, we kind of have to make sure we're giving people accurate information and all that kind of stuff. Or like, so there's a role for lots of different types of scientists to go out and talk to the world. Like, remember during COVID, how important it was that we had people who we could trust. It's like, okay, right, this is serious. Like, so I think those sorts of scientists matter too, right? Or people telling us about climate change, or we can't be cutting turf anymore because of the carbon and all this kind of. If a scientist was seen as just coming down from Dublin and telling people not in the community not to do something that their grandparents had been doing, it's not just good enough to just come in and say you can't do that anymore, it's banned, right? You have to engage with dialogue and realise there may be cultural reasons that go back a long way for why people are doing certain things. As opposed to just coming in saying, we're stopping that now, and you have to do this from now on. It's like, people won't buy that, right? So scientists have to be part of a conversation as opposed to just saying, this is the end of it. Mm. And similarly, going back to COVID a while back, they realised, not so much in Ireland, but more so in England, that what was really important was how the public were establishing trust in public health experts. What were the things that mattered? And there was loads of factors, but one of the things that was really important was it wasn't just a case of them having facts. It was more about other things, about their personalities and about the kind of where they're from and all these things, and understanding whether people trusted institutions as well as people that work in them. So it was really complicated. So when we come to dealing with science in the real world, beyond the fun stuff, and we think about how it applies to our life, it's very complicated in how we establish trust, but it's really important that we give a lot of attention to kind of making sure that we're doing that well and we're not telling people what to do, rather we're talking with people.
Yeah, I think it needs to be more a conversation than chastising. And exactly. I mean, on both sides, like the people, like, again, I'll go back to the flat earth one. You hear people saying the earth is flat because it is, and if you say, like, but what about that, they're like, no, you're wrong, and you're like, well, then this isn't a conversation. And then I go back to the other side. You're like, it's round because of this. And if someone says, but what about that? And then you're like, no, you're just wrong if you think any other way.
So there's the great fellow called, great name, Kasim Kassam, who writes on this conspiracy theory stuff. And he says three things you need to do. You need to kind of explain to them, no, that view is wrong. And then you have to give them sort of like reasonable evidence. But then the third thing he says is you have to talk to the people about why do they believe that.
Yeah.
Right. And he says, often that's the key. It's not just saying, here's my view, that's your view. And they're like, oh, no matter what you say, I'm just going to believe.
Exactly.
So you ask people without kind of trying not to be judgy. And it is hard for us all. It's going, why did you think this is right? And I'm not talking about the evidence, but who told you? On what basis did they tell you that? And if you can kind of trace it back to where those beliefs might come from, and that has to be internal work, right? We have to think about these things. All of us have to do it. Then you start to realize, or maybe there's an agenda, maybe that view is not like a majority view, etc. And it's just getting people into a place where they're able to weigh things up and maybe come about kind of realizing the earth's not flat, which it isn't. Yeah, for sure. We can guarantee you that it's not.
Yeah.
Or chemtrails or the 9/11 one, and there's tons of them. I ask the students in UCD every year, tell me about conspiracy theories, and every year I get new ones from them. So one student was telling me this year there is a widespread conspiracy theory that birds don't exist. I did not know this.
They don't. We've discussed this already, Terry, remember?
Oh, the spy cameras.
Yeah, they charge on the power lines.
Yeah. Trust me, this came up on the podcast about a year ago.
Oh, brilliant. Did you debunk it?
Yeah. Well, I'm still looking at them a bit funny when I'm walking down the road.
The truth is out there, yeah.
We do have a laugh and a joke about conspiracies. Like, I'm a fan of them in the sense of, like, let's say you come in and you're like, this is a conspiracy. If it was true, does it change my life immediately? No. Then I'm happy to discuss that with you. You know what I mean? It's not that deep. It's like
a bit of a laugh.
You know what I mean? And I'm like, right. And then you go through the science and the stories behind it, and it's a bit of a laugh. But then people get married to them and they, like, it's the hill that they're going to die on. You're like, this is not fun anymore.
Fluoride in the water is often the one. If I mention it, I'll get letters, like, you know, if the people write to me in UCD going bananas that I
have someone trying to let that do too much time on the hands. If you said email, I'd be like, right, I get it.
No, I've gotten letters. Yeah.
No, that's the last time you wrote a letter?
No. I'm just now, like,
you know, I wouldn't even know how to send the letter. Genuinely. I'd put it in the post box and be like, I never put a stamp on it.
You're not sponsored by On Post, Jerry.
Not yet.
Yeah.
Right, I think that's a wrap.
Shane, thanks very much for coming in. It was a pleasure.
Thanks, lad.
Thanks very much.
Right, so if you feel inspired after hearing Shane's passion for science, why not get involved in one of the many Science Week events taking place across the country?
This year, they're looking back at the progress we've made thanks to science and technology, as well as exploring tomorrow's questions and challenges it poses for our future.
Find out more on Instagram at Research Ireland.
Right, that's it. Siobhan, take us out. Boom.
Subscribe to this podcast for free on the Go Loud app. What you waiting for? Put your back in it. Just a little more. Throw your weight in it now. Fill your body up. Walk it hard and low. When you finish that.
The Hypnocker.